On the Fringe with Gemma Delaney on WLR.
Welcome back to On the Fringe with me, Gemma Delaney. First up on tonight's show, SETU Waterford's Masters in Music Performance will be holding their public exam recitals with thanks to their course head, Hazel Farrell, and instrument teachers Stephen Mackey, Michael O'Toole and Dylan Bible as well. I chatted with Niamh and Oisin about the upcoming recital.
On Thursday the 4th of December, in SETU College Street Campus, there is three performances. So Martin Flynn is another student who's going to be doing the Masters, So Martin's at 6:30 on jazz guitar. I'm at 7 p.m. on clarinet, and Oisin's at 7:30 on classical guitar.
close enough. I'm 6:30. I'm 6:30 on classical guitar. Niamh then is clarinet at 7, and Martin is 7:30 to 8 on jazz guitar.
You're stressed enough now, you can't even remember the times. And for people to come and see you. Yeah. I'm only messing with you. But what's the concept behind it, I suppose? Because I guess, I have a master's and I had finals, but people didn't have to come see them. So what's the idea behind it? Is it to aid in performance? Is it kind of like a safe space? Is that the thought? Or?
Yeah, I suppose we've been working on these pieces all year. Mm-hmm. And it's an opportunity for us to showcase, first of all, what the Masters is about. And then secondly, to kind of get a nice environment around. And the chapel and dance studio, the college is a very friendly environment to be in. So, just to promote music, suppose. And it's classical and jazz, so there's a mix of both in there. Yeah. And there's some contemporary, I'm playing a contemporary piece. So there's a bit of everything, I suppose, in the mix. And mainly to promote the college music.
And so, that's a nice little segue to my next question. Oisin, what is the course about? What is the Masters about?
Yeah, so we're doing, it's actually a Masters by Research. Mm-hmm. So it's we're kind of closer to independent researchers, I would say, than students attending lectures.
Yeah.
The lectures are, they're called UPMs, where they're not mandatory unless you want to do a PhD. But there's no real, they're kind of supporting modules. Mm-hmm. The actual work that we're doing is all independent research that is kind of new, bringing something new, so it hasn't been done before. So myself, for example, I'm doing my research on the classical guitarist John Williams, not the film composer, Star Wars and Harry Potter, but another one, Australian classical guitarist, same name. And he's kind of the most famous classical guitar performer, mm-hmm. but he retired in 2013 from guitar performance and then started composing an awful lot. And there's been no analytical work really done on him as a composer. And he's still really viewed as a virtuosic kind of performer, mm-hmm. and not really as a composer. So I'm trying to add a different perspective to his kind of work, I suppose, that not as just a performer but as a composer.
So again, for somebody who has never done a master's or who has never done music potentially, when you say analyse his work, so what exactly does that entail, or what do you have to do as part of the course?
Yeah, some of that I'm still figuring out myself. So you kind of, and there's loads of different kind of forms of analysing it. I tend to start from the very basic and then mm-hmm. work my way up. So I'd start looking at the sheet music first. I'd start by listening to it first.
Yeah, yeah.
And jotting down my initial thoughts. Then I'll look at the sheet music and look at the basic things, the form and the structure. Say if it's, some classical terms, I suppose, maybe, but I'll try and avoid them. If there's like a verse and then a chorus and then verse and then a chorus.
And I'll bridge.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. There you go. If it's whatever type of form it is, what key it's in, time signature, and you go deeper and deeper mm-hmm. each time. It's kind of like you're slowly zooming in on the music. So I'd start by the initial stuff, then maybe the harmonic foundations, what chords are where and why is he using this chord here. And then you go further again to notes and interpretive then of in relation to the title even. Mm-hmm. If one of the pieces I'm playing is called When the Birds Return. So I'm trying to see how does the title relate to that music even? Where are the birds? Where mm-hmm. do they go? When do they come back? What are they returning from? and then just right down to what scales he's using, guitar techniques on the instrument. That's where you really get a whole other insight into the piece is when you're actually performing it. Mm-hmm. And that's why the concert we're doing is so important for us, because it's kind of the culmination and the dissemination of our research where we've been working away with the theory and looking at these pieces, and now it's time to actually play them and express them, I suppose, yeah.
Have you chosen then an artist to focus on as well?
Yeah, so my thesis title is Composers and Performers as Co-Creators. So I've picked two composers and one performer and really investigating how they collaborate and work together and what role the composer and the performer have. And as part of that, I'm actually going to be performing some of the composer's works that they composed for the performer. So Marion Inglesby, which is composer in SETU in Waterford, I'm focusing on her and how she has composed pieces for a clarinetist in Dublin, Paul Rowe. And luckily I have an opportunity that Paul and Marion both have worked with me, so I get to play the pieces that they composed, but also play them for, you know, the composer, the performer there. So mine's the clarinet, so it's really just focusing on how they compose these pieces and how they collaborated together. And then I get to add my own stance on this music by playing it myself. So
Is that, and I'm not trying to impose my own, is that not very high pressure performing it for the composer and the performer?
Yeah, definitely. I have, Marion has helped me out a lot now with the compositions, but yeah, it is a lot of pressure, but there is composers who will, you know, allow you to add your own interpretation onto it, which is great, because you can, if you do something, then you can say that's your own interpretation of whatever in so-and-so bar. But yeah, no, it is a lot of pressure. But
I suppose, though, on the flip of that, the fact that they're both local, you can literally go to them.
Yeah.
Whereas,
yeah,
you know, John Williams, you know, of Australia is probably not so easily accessible. Oisin. So I suppose from that perspective,
yeah, no, absolutely, yeah.
You know,
it's
great to have. Literally, them so close. Can lean on them for advice and support and maybe guidance in some areas of it. I suppose then, you know, with the concert itself, like, what can we expect? So it's running for an hour, 2 hours.
6:30 to 8 p.m.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And three of us are playing individually, but within our three performances we have ensemble pieces. So I know that Martin has a band with him, Oisin has a guitar ensemble, and I have my tutor who's playing clarinet also with me. So there'll be a nice variety of pieces played individually and also with ensembles. So you don't just get to see us three play, you get to see multiple other people play as well with us.
So, I mean, in the build up to this, then, Oisin, I'm assuming yous are just rehearsing round the clock.
Yeah. Fairly flat out. Probably should have done more now that we're on a radio station talking about it, as you said, asking people to come and watch.
Now that we're on air peddling our wares, in hindsight, maybe I'm only messing with you. And look, I mean, it sounds like, I mean, when have you started this process then as well? I'm assuming it's months back.
Officially we started in January, but it was probably the previous September that we had originally started, but because of the cyber attack on the college, only officially started in January. So it's been months of practice and rehearsals. Well, the rehearsals really intense. Rehearsals only the last few weeks, and now within this week and next week as well. But yeah, it's been a big chunk.
It's been a while. Yeah, yeah. The cyber attack pushing things back. It was a blessing and a curse in a way. It gave us a lot of time to just build up these pieces. And
when I was doing my master's, COVID hit, and I remember we were that week we had just kind of had to decide what thesis we were doing. We were all kind of, that day the email went out in college, we're like, oh no, shucks. And we're like, yeah, we'll see you bank holiday weekend, we'll go on. And like, that was it then, like 2 years blink and everything was online. But like that, we're initially like God, oh my God, this couldn't have happened at a better time. But of course, like you said, these things are in one way because it drags it out, and it's sometimes better to keep going when you have that momentum. But then as well, it has given you that
extra few months, buffer, as well,
know, as they say. I mean, for anybody who's popping along to the concert, sell it to me. You know, if somebody wants to go to this, or you want somebody to go to this, what would you say is something they're going to really enjoy, or something they're not going to expect from this?
I suppose I'll go first. I would say it is a very high standard of music being performed on the evening. And also, just, I know I already mentioned it, but there's various ensembles being performed on the Thursday evening. And yeah, do you want to help me out here?
of course. So I suppose you can expect a good bit of variety. You know, you'd have myself starting it off with a guitar, which, you know, everyone kind of knows the guitar, but it's classical guitar, so it's looks the exact same really as any sort of guitar you'd see in Aldi even, you know. But it looks very similar to anything, but how it's played is slightly different. You'd be used to seeing a guitar kind of strumming, playing chords, or maybe separately playing lead stuff, but classical guitar, you kind of combine the two, and it's mainly a solo instrument. So I'll be kicking it off, starting with an ensemble piece, with three other guitars, so it'll be a four kind of a classical guitar quartet, Then after the two of them, I'll move on to some solo pieces, three by the composer John Williams, and then one by a composer, Carlo Domeniconi, which is 14, 15 minutes long, depending on how fast I play it. So that's kind of what to expect from me, is just mainly a solo element. And then I suppose from Niamh, who'd be up next, the clarinet kind of being an instrument that I think kind of blows people away a little bit, doesn't it? Like everyone's tried a guitar in their life. Everyone's picked one up and had a go. But you'd look at that and you might as well be looking at a spaceship.
Oh my God.
It's amazing.
It's incredibly hard to even just to blow into it. You know what I mean? I remember one of my best friends back in secondary school was a clarinet player, and she's like, have a go. I'm like, how do you do that? Just even getting it going is so much effort. Do you know what I mean? And then the last student you were saying is
Martin. So Martin's on jazz guitar.
I could take that if you want. I'm just a guitarist, I can get close to it. Different kind of style of guitar. So Martin, then we all love jazz. So Martin with his jazz guitar, he'll be, it's mainly duos and ensemble work he'll be doing. I think he's only doing one solo piece, but interestingly, his research and his performance is based around a Waterford based jazz guitarist, Louis Stewart, who I can't remember the years he was active now, but I think he passed away in sometime after 2010 maybe. And that's where Martin's research is really heavily focused on Louis Stewart and his arrangements of pieces. And yeah, with him, you can expect a lovely mixture of some duo with jazz, some big band stuff, and some solo stuff. And I'd say it's easier to say it about the other two than myself, but you can expect a really high standard, I think, of performer. And I mean, Niamh's amazing. Martin's amazing. It's going to be...
I've absolutely no doubt whatsoever. In terms of tickets, where can we get them? Is there any left?
No, it's a free event, so you just come to the college for 6:30. The 6:30 performance is in the dance studio, and then you come up to the chapel at 7 p.m. for my performance, and then Martin's is also in the chapel at 7:30. So.
On the 4th.
On the 4th of December.
All taking place on the 4th of December. Well, guys, look, you're braver than I am, that is for sure. Like I said, if I had my time back again and I was in my Masters and I had to do my finals in front of people, I'd be like, do you know what? You're all right. Thanks very much. Oisín, Niamh, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
On the Fringe with Gemma Delaney on WLR.
That Small Island, the feature-length documentary created, written and produced by local woman and professor of Irish Studies, Brianna Nic-Niarmida, has just received the Outstanding International Documentary Award at the Newport Beach Festival. Brianna sat down with me to tell me the inspiration behind it and the process of making From That Small Island.
I'm basically a filmmaker that was an academic. I suppose I did a big series for 2016 for the centenary of the 1916 rebellion. So that was a three-part series and a feature-length documentary for cinematic release and single screenings. And we had the great good fortune to have Liam Neeson narrate that. So this time around, I decided we wanted to go ahead and do another. I want to say I'm talking about myself and basically Coco Television, who are the production company. They're one of Ireland's biggest and most successful production companies. You know, they do Dermot Bannon, Room to Improve, First Dates, and various other brilliant programs. So I've had a long-term relationship with Coco, and so we had a really successful series and feature in 2016, which went all over the world. So then that gave me the idea. As we went, I went around the world with it, by the way, as well. Mm. So it was shown in 60 countries. Now, I don't think I was in 60 countries, but I was certainly in four continents, you know. And it was like, God, is Irish history must be sexy. Like, what is this? Mm. Why are people interested in a tiny little country on the edge of Europe, you know, and particularly one particular event there? So what makes this interesting for other people outside the country? And I suppose those questions, so I began to kind of formulate these questions, like, what does it mean to be Irish, you know? And then when you think if we're lucky now, we're 6 million people on the island, 70 million people worldwide say they're Irish, you know, over 40 million in the US say they're Irish. So, like, what does that mean? You know, why is it cool to be Irish? You even look at something almost as silly, but it's not silly. It's hugely important symbolically, I think. And it shows our soft power. You know, when you look at the Leaning Tower of Pisa, when you look at the Christ the Redeemer in Rio, when you look at in China, the Great Wall of China turned green. Yeah. And obviously, of course, the Green Rivers in the US and all that stuff, you know. I mean, no other country can do that. So what is it about the Irish that makes us liked and likable, you know? So it was, those were the kind of questions that started me off. And also, something that had never really been done. There have been loads of histories of Ireland, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was growing up, there was one particular one, Robert Key, called A Television History of Ireland, which was brilliant. I mean, that mesmerised me, I have to say, probably inspired me to go on to do what I do today.
Mm.
But it was of its time as well. And it dealt basically with Ireland and England. You know, that was the eternal question. We either looked at ourselves or we looked at ourselves in relation to our biggest neighbour.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, Irish people have been global since the beginning. And that's really what we found out through this, through making this four-part series for television and a 99-minute feature for single screenings, cinematic release, film festivals and that. So they were the kind of basic questions, like, what does it mean to be Irish? And then we follow the Irish in and out of the island and their comings and goings, as someone said, you know. So that had never been done before, to look at a history of the Irish as opposed to a history of Ireland, and then to follow people as they came from our very first people who came here 10,000 years ago. And there's still questions about that. We're still not even sure who the first people were or where they came from, but they came from somewhere, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. So they came into the island. And then, of course, we've been going out of the island ever since. And so that's, I think, what makes the Irish kind of unique in one sense, you know, this kind of wanderlust, as someone says, from the medieval monks who went off to Europe, you know, bringing their scholarship with them. And so we went off, we followed those people, we followed those monks to places like Bobbio in northern Italy in the company of former President Mary McAleese. We went off to Argentina, where 1 million people there are of Irish descent, many of them, by the way, from Wexford and Waterford region, also from Westmeath, I think, particularly, up to Newfoundland. And we went up to Newfoundland and we were talking to a fellow up there whose family came from New Ross, and he sounded like you or me. Do you know what I mean? Or someone you'd walk out, yeah, you'd walk into the middle of Ross or Waterford and hear them talk. And I said, well, where are your people from, Sean Sullivan is his name. And he said, my people came here, he said, from New Ross, County Wexford. I said, oh, did they? Because I'm from New Ross, County Wexford. And I said, well, when did they come? He said, 1827. I just thought, oh, my God. It was just mad. It was mad. And, you know, I know a lot of people have mentioned this before, but to be there and to see that in the flesh and to hear it, you know, yeah, was just hilarious. And he said, when he comes home, people ask him, where are you from? He says, Canada. And say, oh, Canada, go on, boy. You're from out the road. So, I mean, we had hilarious experiences like that. But it just shows how far flung the Irish are, you know. You know, from the Irish gauchos out in the Argentinian pampas, you know, to Toronto, to New York, obviously, to Australia, literally all over, you know. So we had 4 hours in terms of the television mm-hmm. series to tell the story of 10,000 years of the Irish. So that was a bit of a push, Gemma, to be honest. But it's very exciting doing it. It was a big challenge. And I'm so thrilled now that it's finished and that it's out there and on screen.
Isn't that fantastic? And even as you were talking and talking about the various paths you followed, that was the first thing I thought was, how do you edit that all down? How do you decide what makes the cut and what doesn't? I mean, because that is that's fascinating.
Yeah, with great difficulty is the kind of short answer to that one. But it really is. It was extreme. That's the big challenge, I suppose, you know. So I think we had about 100 and over 100 hours, 120 hours of footage and interviews. And then we had to whittle that down to basically less than 4. And then for the feature to less than 100. So that was huge. So I worked with two brilliant directors, Rachel Moriarty and Peter Murphy. And the three of us worked in the edit then with a series of editors. Actually, we probably had 4 editors. Mm-hmm. We were editing for well over a year and a half. We continued then even to film some. When we were in the halfway through the edit, we thought, you know what, we need someone there on location. So we went off, for example, to Barbados, you know, to tell the story of the Irish who had been sent over there as indentured servants after Cromwell during the 1600s, you know. And that's a story that a lot of people didn't know, you know, that the Irish were over there working as indentured servants which, I mean, they had no, they weren't being paid. They were, you know, they weren't slaves technically, but they worked alongside enslaved Africans mm-hmm. in the fields over there, you know, men, women and children. So that's a story, I think, that a lot of people have passed a lot of people by. So we went over there with Jane Almer from Trinity, who's a great friend of mine, but she's also our historical consultant for this. And she was an associate producer on it as well, along with Linda Cullen and Stuart Switzer from COCO, who are the two main exec producers on it. So we had a fantastic team, you know, both as at an exec level, at the creative level as well. Of course, some of the execs are creative, I better say quickly. But we had a, it wasn't a hard slog, but it was a difficult one. We had to, like, as you say, how do you make the decisions, you know? And so we were obviously able to go into greater detail in the series, because we had an hour to cover whatever, 2,000 years, you know, whereas we could have 10 minutes in the overall part of the feature. But I suppose what we were trying to do was to give an overview, because that's really all you can do, an overview, but an overview that would be tempered by personal experience, you know, mm-hmm. or sort of personal stories. And I think, again, one of the things that I'm so glad that we managed to do with this, and I think we have managed to do, is to touch people's emotions, you know. Like, I think that's the great boon of television and a film, basically. You can get a sense of an emotional heft with this that you don't necessarily get from a book. You know, but you watch a film, you hear the music, and we were blessed with a fantastic narrator, obviously, in Colin Farrell. But also we had an original score by Colin McInerney, who is a brilliant composer, obviously. He's southeast, he's down in Monomaleni from Dublin originally, of Connemara extract. But he did such a job on the score. It adds another kind of 25%, you know. So I think, you know, for a film like this, once you build in everything, like beautiful visuals, even though I say so myself, we had a fantastic cinematographer in Andrew Cummins. So beautiful shots of Ireland, and obviously all the locations abroad. We shot in 17 different locations worldwide. And then the score, and then Colin's voice and as the narrator. Hopefully my script helped a little bit as well. But I think putting all that together, you know, I think we've managed to move people. You know, we show this. I was really privileged to be able to show this at home in Uros, actually, mm-hmm. the end of the summer during the Kennedy Summer School. It opened the Kennedy Summer School. And that was only the second time it had been shown. We had we were nominated as an official selection at the Galway Film FLA. And the next thing then was New Ross, the Kennedy Summer School. And we got a standing ovation, you know, and to have that feeling, and people were crying. They were coming up saying, you should be given a Kleenex with this, or cushions, you know. And it was a lovely occasion, a very moving occasion for me, I have to say, you know, coming from your home place and bringing something like that back and then having that reaction. And of course, we shot a lot around the southeast. You know, we shot in Waterford, Kilkenny, New Ross, out around South Wexford. And so it was funny because the guys when we were in the edit, you know, they'd say things like, where is it you're from again? You know, as we move back to the southeast yet again, you know. but of course, it's a very storied place, the southeast, you know, from Kilkenny down to Waterford to Wexford. And, you know, we bear the Viking with the marks of the Vikings, of course, the Normans, 1798, all of that. And then out to Ring. Actually, one of the parts of both the series and the film that I really, I suppose, feel most proud of is how we deal with the famine. I mean, when you think about the famine, I mean, absolutely massive traumatic event. And we're the only European country that suffered such a thing, you know.
Absolutely.
And I think that gives us a kind of muscle memory, you know, like Concern and Goethe and all of those wonderful NGOs, you know, who do so much work for the poorest people in the world, for the hungry in the world. I think a lot of that and people's generosity, Irish people's generosity generally in terms of that, I think comes from our own emotional muscle memory of those mm-hmm. days, you know. And I think that's something that we need to remember, I think, particularly in the world today.
Absolutely.
I think it gives us a particular perspective. You know, we were that, as Mary McAleese once said, just that fraught and frightened stranger on the shore. And, you know, I think we should remember that when we get fraught and frightened people on our shores as well, obviously. But I think something about that compassion, you know, that was shown to us in many places. That wasn't always shown to us either. When you think No Irish Need Apply, that story that we tell as well. But then the triumph really of the human spirit of that we can see in the Irish story, you know, that's a universal one, I think, Gemma, but it's very specific as well, you know. But I think we can take a universal story of resilience because, you know, the Irish did when they went to the US, when they went to Australia, when indeed they went to Britain. You know, they succeeded. They gave a lot to those countries and they continue to do so, you know. So it's at the end of the day, it's a story of trauma. When you look back at the 1600s here, oh, my God, you know, famine, transportation, enforced movement of people. Awful things, and yet the Irish survived. You know, we changed, and yet we survived. So I think it's a story of hope at the end of the day.
My conversation with Brianna continues after this short ad break.
On the Fringe with Gemma Delaney on WLR.
You started with saying that, you know, the process was kind of you asking a number of questions. Did you find any, you know, discernible answers, I suppose, to those questions?
Only more questions, I think. You know. I suppose some answer. I think, to be honest, and one of the things that I really like about this was how we ended up, to be honest. And we ended on a question. Okay, we do give answers along the way. At this stage, you can say 1600, who were the Irish? You know, 1800, who were the Irish? Where were they? What were they were doing? So we answered those kinds of questions, you know. But I think, I suppose, what we found is that identity is always, it's shifting, it shifts, it changes. You know, it's never the same. And I think how we finish it was with a quote from, a direct quote, obviously, from Gerald O'Toole, who's a professor of history in NUIG. And I've known him for many years. He's a fantastic individual. But he looks into the camera and he says, you know, he said, what Irish identity will mean in 25 years, he said. It will not have a single answer. He said, but what's important is that it remains an abiding question. And we kind of end on that more or less. We do a little bit of tidying up at the very end. But I think that's it. It needs to be an abiding question. I don't think there are any easy answers, you know. I mean, if you look at Waterford, it was founded by the Vikings. It's not hardly a Viking city today. It's a vibrant Irish one, you know. The same thing with the Normans. Kilkenny was a Norman New Ross. These are Norman towns. There are no Normans there today. Are there? Do you know what I mean? I know we're looking back at that aspect of our past and we're celebrating it. But those comings and going down, albeit the Normans and the Vikings, indeed, came at the end of a sword. It wasn't, they weren't being welcomed in or anything.
No.
But yet they kind of, yet they became indigenized. They became Irish, you know. And like by 1798, when the pikemen were out, a lot of them had Norman ancestry. A lot of them had Viking ancestry. So it's, you know, they became Irish. They became indigenized. So I suppose that's one of the things that I certainly learned. I would have known a bit of it, but that just made itself really, really clear throughout the thing as we followed our story, basically. And we interviewed, oh my God, quite a number of basically the top historians. And we also brought science into it, you know, particularly prehistory. We looked at all the insights that we're now getting from, I suppose, the development of technology, particularly in genetics. So they're now able to analyse ancient DNA, and there are two geneticists in Trinity in particular who've done amazing work in this, and another one up in Belfast, Eileen Murphy, she's a professor of osteoarchaeology. So we're actually able to bring Eileen over to a forensic lab in Liverpool, and we recreated the face of a skeleton of a Bronze Age prehistoric skeleton of a man who had been dug up in Rathlin Island. Well, he was in a cist, which is a kind of a stone burial.
Wow.
And so they had to take it out, take that cyst out of there because the dunes were coming in, right? And she'd been studying this individual, studying his entire skeleton. And he was about 5'8", which is really tall for a man of that time. He would have been between 40 and 60. We knew what, because of the DNA, we knew what colour his hair was, we knew what colour his eyes were. So we commissioned, for the first time ever, this forensic face, they're called Face Lab, And they recreated, they digitally recreated what this man would have looked like, you know. And it was amazing. It was fantastic. We brought Eileen over there. I should say Professor Murphy, we brought her over there. And we see her looking at this face as it emerges out of the screen, you know. You get the little bits of muscle coming and then you see the eyes and then you see the hair. And then you see the full face, you know. And this was one of our ancestors, genetic ancestors, who lived 4,000 years ago. So that was a kind of a highlight for me, I have to say.
I have to say, Brina, while I have you on the line, any jobs going? You sound like you're living my dream. I'm listening here and going, this would be my dream job. I'm just an absolute history nerd.
Well, there you go. You see, I think the people in Ireland have a real soft spot for their history, you know.
Yeah, we do.
And yeah, we really do. And it's always fascinated me since I was a child, I have to say. But you're living around here, like, you know, you go down to Reginald's Tower in Waterford, you go anywhere around southeast Wexford. You can't but help being interested in history. Do you know, you're walking through the streets of it every day.
That's
you
so
see
true.
It in front of you, you know. So I think that does leave an impact on Irish people.
And look, we would be remiss not to mention the fact that, of course, you've had a big win in the US. It had its international premiere at the Newport Beach International Film Festival and has won a major prestigious award. That must have been, I mean, that must have just bursting inside with pride. I mean, we're bursting inside with pride for you, you know, and claiming you and going, oh my God, this is fantastic for the Southeast. But I mean, you must have been over the moon, Brina.
I was thrilled, to be honest. Like, it was a long way to go, Gemma. Mm-hmm. I went over by myself because of the cost of getting over there, you know. We couldn't, we got a certain amount to help us go, but I would love to have had, you know, Linda from Coco and Peter and Rachel, the directors, with me. But unfortunately, you know, we weren't able to do that. Just it wasn't possible. But on the way over, it was 24 hours. My God.
Wow.
getting over there. Yeah, seriously. 7 hours from Dublin to Charlotte. A 3-hour stopover in Charlotte that turned into 6 hours because of the shutdown.
Oh, no.
Another 5 hour, 6.5 hours flight after that. So I get in there. Anyway, it was all this. So the very next day, there was a meeting. The Irish Consul General in LA was there, and she introduced it, and we did a Q&A. I did a Q&A after it with the film organisers. And then to hear that we actually won the Outstanding International Documentary Award was phenomenal. I mean, it blew us away. Like, I mean, all the guys at home as well. Obviously, you know, we weren't expecting that, to be honest with you. But it was a real affirmation, you know, for the work, the really hard work of so many people. Also, I have to say, the support of the people who made this doable, you know, people who financed it. We, RTE, obviously, but also, you know, Department of Foreign Affairs, the Ireland Funds. Like, we had philanthropy. So we managed to get this financed, because it costs a lot of money to do things at that level and to go to all of those different countries, you know, and to have our storytelling be put on screen at such high production, with such high production values attached. So we're eternally, I personally, and all of us indeed involved in this, are eternally grateful to all those people and to everyone. When you think of the people that helped us on this, that worked on it, like the editors, the graphic artists, the designers, musicians, all of those people, all the contributors who share their knowledge with us, those on screen, some of them didn't make the screen. We had something like, I think we did interviews with maybe 50, 60 people. And obviously not every single one of them got on to screen, not because they weren't interesting or good, but we just couldn't fit them in, basically. So we had to cut our cloth to a certain extent. But just winning that thing, I think, was a brilliant affirmation for us, you know, for all the hard work.
Well, Brina, as I said, I feel like you're living my dream. Where can we can we watch this ourselves, or where can we watch it, or will it be out for major release, do you think, in the near future?
Well, yeah, so the feature is one, that's the 99 minute. That's a single. That's currently that's in for a good number of film festivals. I think we just heard we got into the New Delhi Film Festival.
That's incredible.
We've been nominated also for one in Berlin, ARFF in Berlin, the Hague International Film Festival. So we're delighted with that kind of, with that reaction, you know, and to have all those laurels that we can put on our poster now is very, very nice and affirming, as I say. But the 4-part series, which went out in on RTE in June, that is still available on the player and can be seen in the player. Anybody in Australia listening to this, or family that you have out in Australia, it's on SBS. It's streaming on SBS, which is one of the big channels out there. It's just on a 4-week transmission week, every Thursday night, I think, but it's still available on the player. And for those in the US, the 4-part series is starting on PBS Coast to Coast, 96% coverage, starting in January. So we're thrilled with the reaction abroad to this.
And I'm absolutely not surprised by that at all, to be honest with you. As you said, at the head of our little chat there, you know, we are a small island, but we have a wanderlust. And as a result, you know, 70 million of us all around the world. So I'm absolutely delighted for you. I'm always so proud to be from the Southeast. But I love an old bandwagon to jump on as well. And God knows I'll be jumping on this, Bree, and I'll be shouting from the rooftops.
I'd be very delighted if you do so, Gemma. And I'd be looking out for any jobs now that we might have going.
Brianna, thank you so much for joining me. I could talk to you all day. We could have done a podcast on this.
There you go. You never know. Hope yet.
Thanks, Brianna.
You're very welcome, Gemma.
As always, a huge thank you to all of my guests tonight. Well, that's all the time we have for On the Fringe, but make sure to check us out every Tuesday, 6 to 7 here on WLR.